Support for WSIU's In the Author's Voice is provided in part by listeners like you. To make your donation, log on to WSIU.org or call 800-745-9748. Thank you.
Welcome to In the Author's Voice. I'm Jeff Williams. Southern Illinois musician and writer Chris Piper is out with a new novel that traces the unique heritage and character of small towns along the Ohio River. Kingsnake, Descendants of Iniquity, is based on the true events that reflect the Antarctic spirit of the region. I recently sat down with Piper to talk about his book for this edition of In the Author's Voice.
And in a way, I'm sort of the accidental author because I've been involved in creative pursuits my whole life, but I've typically focused on music. It was people, you know, some of my best friends had no idea that I'd written for 30 years, that I'd written prose. They knew that I wrote music and lyrics and, manifestos and all sorts of other personal stuff, hobbies. But no one had a clue that I'd have to say fooled around because until the last couple of years, I hadn't applied myself to writing. So my background is simple. I grew up south of here, about as far as you can go in Illinois without running into the Big River, which much of the book is about. And I've always tried to do something special. And when I realized at about age 36 that I would never be a rock star, I thought I'd switch focus. And I had a lot of encouragement from people around me who had essentially just discovered that I was a writer, that I had kind of a body of work even at that point. And they said, man, you got to do this. So I did.
Tell us a little bit about the book. Set the stage for us, if you will, for Kingsnake. It's a story, I think, probably that a lot of folks, especially in this area, will identify with.
Well, I would have to agree and disagree with you simultaneously. And it's one of the reasons I wanted to write it, because although it's about the country, the geographic area in which we live, it's about a world that many people don't ever brush with. We have an understanding of it. Maybe you've seen it on a rerun of Cops or something like that. But when I came to Carbondale, which was 20-some-odd years ago, I don't even remember exactly, I was thrown in with a population. It was predominantly a transplant population from Chicagoland area. And I had this kind of hayseed idea that my experiences and some of the characters I'd known would just sort of translate around the country, and that everyone would say, oh, sure, I've known people just like that. And I was disabused of that notion very quickly. I found that just swapping a simple, innocent story about something that I'd always taken for granted, about the area I came from, would just blow people away. You know, I would get a, dude, no way, shut up, oh my God. And I was, you know, it got to where I felt like I was lying about some of this stuff. I mean, honestly, I think one of the reasons I wrote this was to get it down and put my name on it and have it official and say, now, go check it out. You know, if you have nothing in your world that you can relate to this, I'm sorry, I apologize. But this was my world. This is how I grew up. And certainly the main theme of the book, what I like to think, I'm very interested in the land and weather, meteorology, climate, these things. And the main theme of the book, as best I could explain it, would be that the proximity of the huge river and the history and the founding of my hometown, which I will not mention by name because they would probably sue me. The history of the founding of that town is it was founded by hustlers, by pirates, by moonshiners, by a bunch of people that wanted to get rich quick. And they were hard, hard people. And the remnants of that blood is still there. And so if I grew up knowing these characters that were particularly colorful, we'll say, and interacting with them and even getting involved in a few things that were maybe a little unconventional, my own self, I decided at some point in my life that the river had a lot to do with it. You know, that the nature of the people who went west on the big rivers to settle in some ways determined the nature of the towns. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to explain that world, that town, that scene, me, all of it.
You have a number of characters that appear throughout the story and help tell the story. Leon and Big Randall and Donnie. I think I found Leon interesting. I know, having grown up in a farm community not too far from here,
sure.
I think everyone, or at least most of my friends,
knew someone like, or had someone like Leon
in
their lives that they rubbed elbows with or bumped up against, either through school or in their lives afterwards, in the community, and whatever their life might be at that time. Tell us about him in the context of the book, because he seems to have a profound impact, or at least is intricately woven into the life.
Leon is obviously one of the anchors of the book. Mm-hmm. The book is divided into three installments, three stories, mm-hmm. long stories, I have to call them. And I chose to start with Leon because he's based on a character, based quite thoroughly on a character that I encountered first in junior high. He, as it says in the book, he transferred to my school. And Leon is, as you said, many of us know someone who, who can tell the story about a character like Leon Runkle. And I wanted to do that at face value. I wanted to tell his story and his effect on me and the direction of my life. And the story, essentially the plot line is having a real seminal experience with a guy in junior high and then essentially falling out of touch with him for several years and then reuniting. And mm-hmm. as we'd both been busy trying to grow up, and he's certainly more busy than I in a much more serious way. But what I felt like
he had some rather interesting extracurricular activities.
Very much so. We were all hobbyists down there, and some of us took it a little further than others. But the thing about Leon is he was a great example of it, and the thing that I knew instinctively, even when I was young, is that there was something truly American about this guy. I believe I put it explicitly in the book that mm-hmm. he really believed in opportunity. And mm-hmm. if I saw the guy tomorrow, and honestly, I'm not certain if he's alive or dead. I'm not. I tend to believe he's alive after a fashion. But if I saw him tomorrow, I have a feeling that that American belief in opportunity and that energy mm-hmm. would be the same and intact. And I wanted to try and capture some of that. This was a guy who could talk to you 1 second about where he bought the German paratrooper knife that he was showing you, and the next second about how he was matter-of-factly considering going to Afghanistan to fight the Russians for $400 a day or whatever. And he meant it all. And he deeply affected me. I was young enough to understand that there were some very serious people in the world, and he represented that to me, a link to that serious blood, and truly to the founders of the area who were bloodthirsty pirates. Was the polite way to put that. Mm-hmm.
The story is told from the narrator's mm-hmm. Perspective. And in the beginning, I thought it was interesting. You write, "I am the last of many things." What do you mean by that?
I would suggest you take it exactly at face value. There are legal considerations in discussing any of this in too much detail. Unfortunately, a lot of that has to do with mortality. And mm-hmm. a lot of the people, including some of the best friends I've ever had, a lot of the people I was close to working in my life, and again, some very unconventional occupations, a lot of them are gone, truly gone from the planet, passed away. And I was unlucky in that I was exposed from an early age to this. A friend can be here one day and gone the next. And mm-hmm. the rougher you live, the higher that percentage goes up. I am the last of many things. I have to believe that. I think it may sound pretentious, and there is a lot of pretense in it. I do mean it at face value. Let's take a real harmless and fun example. Told you I was 36 before I realized that I was not going to be a rock star, and that was a tough day, let me assure you. But in a way, I was the last holdout. I had, at 36, my band had just broken up, and it was the best band I'd ever been in. Never been more focused, never felt more in tune with anyone, and rarely felt such a sense of mission in doing something creative. And it, as many things like that do, it dissolved and went away. And that's, again, just a very innocent example. And I see myself as really the last holdout, I still believe life should be extremely special. And, mm-hmm. I talk, and I've got quite a lengthy author bio, and I talk about what I call the entropy of potential. And there seems to be an expectation that as we age, we stop dreaming. And maybe that's what I mean. Maybe I feel like I'm the last dreamer. And I know that's not true, but It sure feels like it sometimes.
In the book, the hometown is Smoke Bend.
Smoke Bend, yes.
Tell us about
somewhere
Smoke.
In Oregon.
Tell us about Smoke Bend.
Well, you know what? I wanted to fictionalize the name of the town. It's there were a few things that that I could not relate exactly as they were verbatim in the book, and again, mostly for legal reasons. I don't want to get sued. And my hometown, I have a rather torturous relationship with it. You know, I don't remember it fondly in the sense that many people do, and I envy them for that, growing up in a place and having, you know, great memories of it. I remember more, honestly, from about age 6 on, is feeling like I had a target painted on my head. And so, I mean, I don't want to get into the classic persecuted artist, no one understood him thing, because it's not that simple. Mm-hmm. But I don't go back there often, even though it's only an hour away. I still have family there, but I tend to avoid visiting. What I wanted to do in renaming the town, the purpose, besides dodging a lawsuit, I wanted to give it a name that was right in line with the people who did settle it. And there was a tremendous history, especially on the river, in the river bottoms area of Moonshining. This area was dry until the 50s, and certainly that county until the 1950s. And you still can't buy a beer on Sunday in most places, a lot of these small towns. And so I believe in the book I say that the history of the name is torturous and malleable, but it's at least loosely related to the fires of early whiskey cookers. Mm-hmm. And there's some truth to that. In fact, in the area I live right now, near Devil's Kitchen Lake, the reason it's called Devil's Kitchen is because of the history of moonshining in the area. And what I've heard from someone who was alive and lived through the time is that when the smoke hung thickest over the place, that's where it got its nickname, because they were all down there cooking with green wood to make liquor. Mm-hmm. So calling it Smoke Bend it needed to be evocative. It needed to make you think rough people had settled it. And as far as making up names, they come rather quickly. And I try not to think much more about them once I'm done. I say, yeah, that's good. All right. Smoke Bend. Perfect. And you know, it was, as much as anything, I think I was also trying to be polite to my hometown. I didn't want to peg it as an awful place full of savages, because it's not that simple. And but that's it in a nutshell. Mm-hmm.
I find that really interesting, and also it was very much related to that aspect of the story, having grown up in a small community. I think many people that have grown up in small rural communities, especially in this region of the country, can identify with that. And there are probably more than a few of us that don't have any interest, for whatever reason, of really going back home.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. Sure.
It's an interesting kind of coming-of-age story, weaving together all these different experiences and within the region. And you do mention a number of locations, a number of communities by name. Is there significance to your choice in settings of which part of which story occur in which communities?
There is. The centerpiece of the book, and I mean that quite literally, it's just the center story of three, mm-hmm. second story of three, Constrictor. This is set in a village, and it is technically a village, not a town or a city, called Joppa, which exists on the Ohio River. And I deliberately chose to use Joppa to give a shout out to Joppa on this one. This is one of those things, kind of, you had to be there. Joppa has a reputation in the area, or at least had a reputation. For all I know, it is a bucolic suburban community now, but I highly doubt it. It had a reputation for a certain rough edge that was rougher than anywhere else around. And I maybe it sounds unfair or patronizing in some way, but I almost thought that the good people of the village of Joppa would want me to use the name of their town. And I wouldn't even call it resentment, but the complex feelings I have about my own town, I don't have about Joppa. It was sort of like venturing into, going into a very dangerous part of Lebanon or something, where you didn't have to disguise the name. Everybody knew it was bad there, and it was hard, and it was special. I think that's probably more. It's not that it was bad. It's a very special place. And I debated about that. And then it just felt right. And the few Japanese that I, local Japanese that I still have any sort of intermittent contact with would agree with me on that. I think they'd be fine with me using the real name of their town, their village. I'm sorry. Mm-hmm.
Chris, is there a reading maybe, something from the book that you'd like to share? Give listeners a taste of what's in the book.
There's, I guess I'd want to give you just a little bit of introduction because, again, so much of this book has to do with geography and climate, issues like that. I mean, not that I don't want to, it's not like an environmental book or, a textbook. It's just the land is the setting. If I were writing in a city, then I would say so much of this book has to do with the city and, the trash in the gutters. But that's not what I'm writing about. So it's about the land. The river is, again, it's the center of it all. The river runs through the middle of it. And, that sounded really cliched, but it's true. It runs through the center of it. And I wrote the epilogue when the Ohio and the Mississippi River were at record flood stages just over 1 year ago. And this year in May, which would have been 1 year since I wrote the epilogue of the book, we were in record drought, what they were calling exceptional drought. So it was just night and day. And emotionally, to think about the place I was in when I finished the book, it was a big leap. So I like to read this to remind you of what it's like when the rain falls and what it's like when nature just gets bigger than you ever thought she could. And in another way to not to get too grandiose here, but I want to indicate the place in the hearts of the people who live down there that the river has, or at least it doesn't mind. I can't speak for them all, but this is the epilogue, and I wrote this after we had received 19.4 inches of rain in 60 hours. So, and now it is flood. The long bargain with forces underestimated must be honored. That ancient channel flows tonight beneath a muddy lake several miles wide, all of it creeping down the continent with an energy that is almost angry. The planet churns and scours and rages at us for our unforgivable transgressions. We, all sinners dumb before its wrath, weep in the punishing rain, as if it had soaked so thoroughly into our heads that the wetness pressed outward in unsalted, streaming tears. Almost 30 inches of rain here in 2 weeks. I am 60 miles from the big river, but last night the uniform thunder of 10,000 pounds of explosives rolled down my street and shook the windows of my home. The Corps of Engineers had packed an obscure and tiny levee in the Boot Hill of Missouri with a brutal mix of chemicals and blew the thing sky high. The great river was relieved. It turned its wrath from the doomed town of Cairo and found instead the soothing alluvial race of 200,000 acres of farmland. And we are relieved. The rumble and shake of that huge bomb caused giddiness in us all, jammed here in this tiny, weird triangle of hard country. In a cold and steady rain, men had made their own thunder, attempting to distract and pester a marvelous force, to persuade it into sweetly sparing all those towns and homes built where they should not have been. It is epochal, and I find myself wishing I had a Bible on hand so I could consult daily with the mad divinist of the Book of Revelations. Before the breaching of the levee, the crest was predicted to top that of the last 100-year flood. That had come in 1937, when my 2-year-old father was carried for hours through knee-deep streets to reach dry ground. We were going to top it this time, and the exposed and the insulated alike felt the weight of this listing world. The weight is lifted, if only for one rare sunny day, and the people fill and stack sandbags with the energy of the hopeful. It is a futile thing, but we have always done it. In the bottoms and by the big creeks, they live as if taking the rest of the world up on a grand dare. For most of each year, denial and cockiness are protection enough, and validation that they, the daring, are indeed stronger than the forces that carve this world. For my life since first memory, I have dreamed of the big river, of women and children wailing on its shore in relentless cold night rain, of a terrible steel bridge to which I could barely cling and hand walk, with the filthy, churning grayness seeming 1,000 feet below, of vain attempts to lead others, boatloads of refugees and chains of scared swimmers, across the illogical breadth of water which could widen at any time to become an ocean. And finally, I dreamed of walking its channel, bone dry, with its perpetual mud baked and glazed like melted brown glass. The sun shines hard in that one. Now when I think of my hometown, it is also like a dream. I see that gray water seeping in and through until it covers it over, staying forever. It is like some crazed freshwater Atlantis with the saurian shapes of alligator garfish threaded half through the crank-out windows of the flooded trailer homes. They are the new serpents, but the old ones never left. I dream them sucked and choked down into the foul settlement, still fighting and drinking and growing dope and robbing each other, their movements slowed by the wet resistance of this changing reality, falling always a little more behind, but staying, and they will stay there. They will forever look for that big adventure, and I will be there with them.
Chris, was this in writing King Snake, was it in some way a release for you, or freeing of you know, your past growing up?
Absolutely. This, anything I write is catharsis. It's almost improbable to say that, or unbelievable to say that. There has to be a paragraph I've written that was just for fun, right? No. I think writers terminally need to explain themselves. I finally figured it out. I think we don't so much want adoration as we want understanding. And I don't want validation as much as verification. It was a hugely emotional experience to write this, because it is about growing up. All the stories are set in the mid to late 1980s, and it was a very different world then. I mean, it sounds crazy to say that only 25 to 30 years ago. It was a very different world. And so to write about it, it was a huge release. It was cathartic. And this is something I never thought I'd be admitting on the radio, but when I wrote the epilogue, see, I thought the book was finished. And then I sat through the 30 inches of rain in 4 days or whatever. And I realized that there was just one more thing I had to say. And I wrote the epilogue, just those few pages. And I got to tell you, I broke down. I really did. Didn't imagine I'd be singing into a microphone, but it was hugely emotional and cathartic, beyond anything beyond mixed martial arts that I can imagine. It was great for me, and it's one of the reasons I feel so lucky to be doing this and to have had some success at it, is because it just feels like it's so good for me, emotionally, in all ways, and when it works. It's good for everybody who knows me. I'm much happier, friendlier guy. So, but yeah, there was tremendous release, catharsis involved in this, and I assume in everything I write.
You talked about the theme, the prominence of the river, and all that means, and impacts, and in a variety of different ways. What do you hope that the reader takes away from the experience?
Well, I wouldn't have known this until I published it and people started talking to me, people that that knew me but didn't know anything about my background necessarily. I would hope that they look into, again, that world that I talked about that I feel exists in the shadows. Most of us know about it, but few of us don't, you know, brush with it or wallow in it, as I did for some years. I would hope that they take away, let me try and start this again. I would hope that first they take away that I tried very, very hard to get something across. And they can decide for themselves what that is. Secondly, and this probably most importantly, I would want people to know that I met you, for instance, 15 minutes ago. And so I assume I know nothing about you. Most people don't operate that way. And we are... we're very presumptuous beings, and I think we grow more so as our society evolves, so to speak. And I would want people to say, wow, you never do know the full story about anyone, do you? I believe that that's probably most important to me, because when I started getting reactions from people that I just guessed they knew me pretty well. I mean, what you see is what you get. No, they were blown away. And honestly, I tend to see some of the hijinks in the book as, while not being innocent, but there were a lot worse things that happened down there, and I tried to keep it on the humorous side. So, but that's pretty much it. Just that we don't know everyone's story.
That's author Chris Piper. His latest book is Kingsnake, Descendants of Iniquity. Piper will also give a reading from his book on Friday, September 21st at the Long Branch Coffee House in Carbondale from 7 until 9 p.m. In the Author's Voice is an online production of WSIU Public Radio, a listener-supported service of Southern Illinois University, Carbondale.